right. Well, we're just about a few minutes after 6:30 here, so we'll go ahead and get started with our time tonight as folks continue to arrive. But my name is Bill Gorman, and I'm the campus pastor at our Brookside campus. And Tom and some of the rest of the crew are out of town, so I get a chance to jump in here tonight and be with you. So I'm really excited about that. And just wanted to remind us a little bit of where we have been. We're well into the second semester now of Raisers 1, and we began Raisers 1, and I think you have this diagram again in your chart, you probably are tired of seeing this diagram now, but reinforcement, repetition is always a good thing. We began asking this question: how do we live the life that we long to live, this tome life, this integral life? How do we bridge the gap between our beliefs and our behaviors? And so we started with that question, this big idea of this tome, worldview, this tome life, the way that we live, and we explored that idea. And then we went into, well, if the most important thing about us is what comes into our mind when we think about God, we wanted to get that right. So we spent some time looking at the fear of God, the love of God. And then we began to say, so we've got these beliefs about God, but how does that actually connect to our behavior? And we looked at this idea of the bridge that combines or connects belief and behavior are the practices, the spiritual disciplines. And so really the last, since right after, right before the break, and then up until this week, we've been looking at the disciplines. What are spiritual disciplines? How do they work? Why are they important? And that's that bridge. So it's really sessions 10 through 14 focused on the disciplines. And tonight we're going to be making a shift now into the last half, or I guess third, the last third of Raisers 1, which really talks more about behaviors. How do what we believe about God begin to interact with how we live in the world? Oz Guinness, The Call, has been a lot about that. How do we understand our calling? We're going to have a session on that next week. And thinking about leadership and community. How do we as a church function? How are we leaders within our business and culture and life outside of the church as well as inside of the church? So that's a little bit where we're at on the map of Raisers. So we've looked at beliefs, we've looked at the practices, and now we're going to be exploring, at least during the session times, a bit more of the behaviors. Although I'm excited, you know, in the coming weeks, you'll have an opportunity to actually practice some of the disciplines. So there's some exercises that are going to give us just a little bit of a taste of some of these disciplines to try them out. So even though we're kind of moving on from talking about the disciplines during this time, I hope that in our small groups and in our time throughout the week, we'll still continue to think about how are the disciplines and that we'll begin trying out some of those together as a community. Even as we've kind of moved on from them as a topic in these times. So as we look at this topic tonight, we're looking at Christianity and culture. And Christianity and culture is one of those things that I think is the source often of a lot of conflict between Christians. And so I was going to actually bring this up later, but I'll bring it up right now. Really, what we're going to do in this session tonight, in some ways, is answer the question, what's the difference between Bill Hybels, pastor of Willow Creek Community Church, and the Amish? Now, you might say there's a lot of differences between Bill Hybels, pastor of a 20,000-person church in suburban Illinois, and the Amish in Pennsylvania. But what it comes down to, what's really, because if you ask an Amish person about Jesus and what they believe, the core of the gospel, and you ask Bill Hybels, they'd probably give you very similar answers. Really, the core of what's the difference between Bill Hybels and the Amish is how they approach culture. How do they understand the church's relationship to culture? And this can go for all kinds of different people. So a lot of times, even Christians who have very similar beliefs about doctrine have very, very different approaches to culture, the way they interact with the world. And so tonight during our session, we're going to be just exploring a little bit how does the church, how do Christians who make up the church relate to culture, the world around us. And so we see this in a little bit of a hint of this in the Bible in 1 Chronicles 12:32. And if you have a Bible, I'd encourage you to open that and take a look at that verse, 1 Chronicles 12:32. And the verse says this. You don't often find in Chronicles or some of these books, you're surprised, I think, to find some of these things. But there's a little nugget tucked away here, and you would miss it if you went over it too quickly. But it says this. Of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, 200 chiefs and their kinsmen under their command. So in this section, it's listing David's mighty men. It's listing kind of these warriors and all this thing, stuff that's happening there. And it's going tribe by tribe. And it describes the tribe of Manasseh as men who had understanding, people who had understanding to know of the times, to know what Israel ought to do. And we have a couple of maps here. Brian, if you could put those up. The reason why this is significant, so this is a map of Israel during the Old Testament and time period, and you see the land of Moab, you see Judah down there, but you see the different tribes. And Issachar is tucked right up there toward the Sea of Galilee, and you got Manasseh on either side of the Jordan River, and then you have Issachar there. And the placement of Issachar is significant for this text and why they're described as people who have understanding. Because Israel, and we don't, do we have another map that shows the broader? Yeah, so, okay, so there, we have zoomed in here. Israel is situated between sort of the Persian area, the Egyptian Empire. Everyone has to go through Israel to get to the major parts of the world. It's a really valuable piece of real estate. Tom always says it's Israel, in sort of geographically, is like Boardwalk and Monopoly. It's this really valuable piece of real estate. Everyone has to pass through it. And Issachar is right on the highway. They're sitting on I-35 or 435. Everyone who's going through Israel crosses through the tribe of Issachar. And so they're constantly having people stay with them, stop over with them. They're able to learn what's going on, not only in Israel, but in Egypt and Persia and all these other nations around them, because everyone's passing through. And so they are able to understand what's going on. They learn. It has a lot to do with wisdom. In fact, First Chronicles as a book has a lot to do with wisdom and kind of how God's people ought to interact in the world. But Israel and Issachar specifically is a nation, is a tribe within the nation of Israel that is uniquely situated to understand the times. And it says that not only do they understand the times, but they know what Israel should do. They're able to reflect on the culture of the world around them, understand it, understand the significance of what's happening, but then also know what should the nation of Israel do in response to what's happening around them. So the question then for us is, how do we, as people here in Kansas City, Missouri in 2012, become like that tribe of Issachar, become people who understand the times, and then know what we as the church, both here at Christ Community and the church more broadly scattered throughout culture, know what we should do. And that's what we want to focus on tonight. How do we relate to the world around us? How do we understand it? And then how do we respond, engage, be present within it for the good and glory of Christ and his church? Because God is at work restoring this tome that was lost. And what role do we have to play in what he's doing in the world around us? That's what we're looking at tonight. So you see the next bullet there is, how do we understand the times? And I'll just throw out a question here. What sorts of things do we do to try to understand, to discern the times? What kind of things do you do as you think about how do you understand the world around us? Where do you go for information? And then, you know, kind of what role does the Bible play in that? How do you go about understanding it? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I love that picture. So we're looking at the world, what's happening, and then we're reflecting on a scripture. That's great, Cynthia. Yeah, other responses. Where do we go for, or how do we attempt to understand the times? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, reading good novels, seeing good films, definitely give us an insight into the world around us. Good, very good. Yeah, Joan.
Well, just making sure we kind of insulated ourselves with all might come to.
Yeah.
Making sure, I mean, whether it's like work or volunteer, whatever, but making sure we're still really out there learning what are people all about.
That's great. Yeah, that's really good. So we can't understand the times if we're totally isolated in the bubble of people who think just like us. Actually, You know, the people who study social networks are saying increasingly, you know, Facebook and those kind of places, they are able to so tailor because they see what you're posting and what other people and what you like, that they are only showing you things from people who are like you. So one of the dangers even in social net, so you continually see posts from friends that you often like stuff, and so even our world is shaped in information culture, the way it's filtered, that we see a lot of people who are like-minded, whether it's our political position or our sports teams or whatever, and we don't have access to people who think differently. So that's really good. So we got to be exposing ourselves to those who are different, the world around us. Very good. Yeah, others. Traveling. Go a little deeper with that, John. Like, what do you mean? I like it.
I spent a semester in Ghana, and that was just an exposure to a totally different culture, different way of life. What they had access to.
Yeah.
So I don't know, it gave me a different view on their culture versus ours. So when I came home, I had a totally different view of what was different cities, whether New Orleans or New York City, really diverse. New Orleans is like little pockets of rich and poor, you know, almost block to block. Kansas City is like miles of block.
Right. Yeah, this could almost be a map of Kansas City with, like, you know, Wyandotte, Johnson, north of the river here, and there's a lot of wealth right here and a lot of poverty in some of these other, yeah, that's interesting. Good. So those are great. So we're looking at, travel, and we can travel actually by physically traveling to places. We can travel by reading a good book or by watching a film that exposes us to something different, reading good news coverage, listening to good news coverage, watching good news coverage to be aware. I mean, awareness is a big part of it. If you don't know what's going on, it's really hard to interpret and have a framework. So, good. Well, as we think about just a little bit of background, even understanding our times, specifically as the church is related to culture, just wanted to give a little bit of background. During the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s in the United States, there was something called the fundamentalist-modernist controversy. And what happened during those early part of the 20th century was what you had was you had a lot of scholars in Germany, in particular, who followed a very Enlightenment view. They began to question the authority of Scripture. They didn't believe that it was inspired by God. They thought that they tried to take out all the supernatural. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, you know, Tom mentioned last week a little bit, was very influenced by this Enlightenment German school of thought, Kant and others. And what you had happening in that period of time is you had a lot of American pastors and professors who were being trained in Germany and then coming back and bringing this sort of modernist approach to the Bible, to the church, to the United States. And particularly into places like Princeton, Harvard, Yale, these all were places that had leading seminaries that were training pastors. The professors and then who had been trained in Germany were now shaping this generation of pastors and leaders. And then there was this the fundamentalist group that emerged to say, no, they're really, they're undermining, they're eviscerating the biblical faith. And what happened is that at the end of the day, the fundamentalists, this group of fundamentalists, they pulled, and that has a very negative connotation in our world today to be a fundamentalist, but it was really a fundamentalist in doctrine. There was these five fundamental doctrines that they kind of centered around. So if you hear the name B.B. Warfield or J. Gresham Machen, these were men who were at Princeton, Yale, and other places who were really defending this sort of more traditional understanding of Scripture that was around. But what happened is that the modernists ended up taking over basically all the cultural institutions. So then that's why, you know, Harvard was a very conservative divinity school a number of years ago. Now it's in a very, it's much more mainline, much more progressive. So the culture was broadly being shaped by the modernist movement. And rather than remaining in those institutions, and they did try, but the fundamentalists actually ended up pulling out and creating a set of parallel institutions. So this is where Bible colleges came out. So Moody Bible Institute, Calvary Bible College, where I went to school, all these were created in the early 1900s as an alternative to these divinity schools, these places for training pastors that had existed. And because of that, then you had this whole entire Christian subculture that began to emerge. So you got their own publications and music, and there was this Christian culture emerged that was entirely separate from the primary institutions that were influencing the whole of culture. So by the time you get to the 1970s, the main public and cultural institutions of the United States no longer supported the basic Judeo-Christian beliefs about life and morality. And so therefore, it even changes how we think about evangelism, because maybe 50, 60 years ago, you could assume that when you were talking to someone that they shared at least a biblical, somewhat biblical view about who God was. They maybe didn't think God was as holy as he actually is, or that they were as sinful as they actually were, but you didn't have to define the concepts of sin or God. You just had to bring a more biblically robust understanding of those terms. But now, in our culture, the first step is even to say, well, who is God? Why does he exist? What is sin? Why should I care? We're in a very different place. So this creates a cultural crisis for the church. So how are we to understand and relate to the culture as it's shifted, as it's changed? And so this is really where we get to this idea of what is the difference between Bill Hybels and the Amish. It's how they've answered that question of how do we relate to the culture around us as it shifts. So what separates them as their approach to culture? And there's three broad ways. This is now under the bullet, Christianity and Culture. There's three broad ways that Christians have tended to approach their relationship to the broader culture. And obviously there's nuance and overlap there, but the kind of these extremes, and I want to start there, to kind of serve to clarify and understand the relationship between Christ and culture. So the first there you see is accommodation. Accommodation says we as a church are going to become more like, as the culture changes, we're going to become more and more like the culture. It's a low barrier of entry. They're not going to demand a lot of doctrinal commitments. There's a coziness, a closeness with the culture. And really what it leads to is the culture transforming us, influencing us as the church, rather than the church influencing, transforming, being a faithful presence within the culture. And as that happens, the culture, or the church and the culture increasingly become one. There's really no distinction between the two. And this is probably the biggest temptation for most of us in the contemporary church right now. I mean, we want to be, you know, in our church context, it would be much easier to adopt a position on the issue of gay marriage and homosexuality that's like the broader culture than to take one that's contrary, that's a counterposition to the broader culture. And so our temptation is often, I think, in contemporary church to say, we want to be more like the culture. And it's usually driven out of a good motive. We want people to understand the good news of Jesus. We want to be able to relate. We don't want to turn people off. So it's not all like, well, we just want to give up what we believe, but we want to be accepted by the broader culture. We want to have people understand the good news that we understand. The second one is separation. So if that's on one side, where we become like the culture, separation is the other extreme. And this is a high barrier of entry. So if you're in a separationist, more separationist context, you're going to have a really high bar for entry. I had a professor in college who talked about, you know, there's these churches that were so concerned. You know, there's some churches that say, well, there's like, we believe the churches in our denomination really get it. There's some churches that believe, you know, it's just those churches in our city that get it. And then there's some churches that's like, well, there's us, we get it right, and there's maybe that one church in New Jersey, but everyone else is getting it wrong. So it's just this further separation where it's a really high, you have to believe like us on every single thing. It's a very high bar to get in there. It's a lot of us versus them language. It's sort of the posture of we're going to build the walls, we're going to keep the culture out, we're going to separate ourselves from it. And often, again, this kind of links up, this is what happened in the fundamentalist modernist controversy. This separationism began. And so rather than having this posture of engaging with the culture, basically the fundamentalist movement said, we're done. And we're just going to pull out. We're going to do our own thing. We're going to create a subculture that's just completely separate. We're done engaging. And so what happened there is often that was coupled with, this isn't necessarily true today, but it was very much coupled with an anti-intellectualism, which led to an increasing loss of influence in the broader culture. And usually, kind of a separationist, it involves some test kind of for true believers, whether it's, you know, you hold to a certain view on this set of social issues, or even the Amish with the lack of technology saying, you know, we're not going to use a certain level of technology. That's kind of the separationist perspective. So before we go on to faithful presence there, maybe just throw out the question, how have you felt maybe the temptation to either one of those directions? I don't know if anyone has a story of you, or you, maybe where have you felt most pulled in your church experience, past or present? Which one of those most, what do you most relate to? Yeah, Keith.
I grew up in a town of 900 people. We had 12 churches. Each one of them was certain that every other congregation was going to hell. And that's a big part of how I grew up. But one other comment I want to make is, last week, a friend of mine who lives in our old town in Illinois, he's Catholic, and happened to be driving after all the church we were involved with before, and he said, I don't think it's the first thing.
Right. Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Keith. Yeah, others, do you feel like where you, or maybe even another way to frame this is where do you feel like, what are some of the issues that we're tempted to be more like the culture, or maybe to be too unlike the culture? Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's really right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think the biggest flaw in a separationist approach is, where in whatever its form, is it, the temptation in separationism is to think that the problem is really out there and not in here. And I think that oftentimes, you know, because I mean, I grew up, my parents were very much that way. And there is a rightness to saying, oh, I'm not going to send my kids into the worst of the worst, or have them see all these, you know, films or whatever. But if we don't recognize that fundamentally at a core level, this is why monasticism actually doesn't end up working. You can separate yourself completely into a monastery, but if your heart is still full of junk, if you're not regenerate, if you're not, even if you are, it's, sin is still going to creep in, because it's the main problem, and Jesus says this in the Gospels, is not what goes into us that makes us unclean, but it's what comes out of a man's heart, what out of a person's heart that makes them unclean. I think that's a flaw. Often separationism, you think, okay, if we can just get away from all the evil influences, then we'll be able to live the life that we are called to live. And it doesn't take seriously the fallenness of our own hearts.
It's contrary to being called to life.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
And then up on the flip side, up on the other side, the accommodation, then you kind of go, we're not seeking the approval of man.
Yeah.
Which is where that goes. So
exactly.
You play that all out.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, there's a lot of tensions, because you can, I mean, as a separation, if you take that part, I mean, you can find a lot of verses that would say, you know, you need to separate, be holy, be, and then you can also go through, and there's a lot of passages of Scripture that say, no, you need to be really engaged. You need to be salt and light. We need to be active. And so it's something where we are constantly having to manage those tensions. So faithful presence, this is a way forward. You see that bullet there, faithful presence. Both accommodation and separation are ways of gaining power in culture, assimilation, like you're saying, it gives us credibility with the culture. Again, you can gain power by vilifying the world in a separationist view. But faithful presence takes seriously the notion that we are in the world, but not of the world. And like I was saying, that means there's a lot of tension to be held in balance. What does it mean to be in the world, to be in contact with the world, to be active in the world, and yet not to be shaped by it? You know, this idea that Paul says in Romans 12 of be transformed, don't be conformed, don't be shaped by the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And this is what, hopefully, this is what we at Christ Community strive for. It's a third way that kind of goes in between these two extremes. But it's a unique thing. It's a different way forward. So it seeks the center, and it tries to use the best of all the different models while avoiding the pitfalls of each. And this is where I want to go. I put up this big diagram on the board, and don't necessarily feel like you have to copy all this down. This is from a book called Center Church by Tim Keller, so this isn't my, I didn't create this whole thing, but I think it's really helpful, and I want to spend a little bit of time with it, because while there are these accommodation-separation views within those, and there's more nuance, and this, I think, helps us capture some of that nuance. So I want to talk about, there's four sort of perspectives here: relevance, transformationalist, two kingdoms view, counterculturalist, and I just want to kind of quickly go through those, and then sort of see what does each one of those contribute to a faithful presence perspective. So relevance, and actually, so if you see here on the top, just to kind of orient us to this diagram, on the top you have full of common grace, and common grace is the idea that God has given general revelation to all people. So if you look at Psalm 19, the world is speaking, God is revealing himself in the creation, in sciences. I mean, this idea that God is showing himself to the world, and then there's this idea of special revelation or special grace, which is his word, revealing specific things about him. So common grace says that all people everywhere are made in the image of God, that there's goodness in the world. So on the top, you see these perspectives, two kingdoms, relevance, they're full of common grace. They emphasize common grace. Down here, these views, culture, counterculturalist and transformationist, there's a much lower view of common grace. On this side of the diagram, you see these groups, two kingdoms, counterculturalist, they're passive in influencing culture, whereas the relevance and the transformationist, they're more active in addressing culture. So one way to think of this as it relates to accommodation and separation, those that have a high view of common grace, emphasize common grace, they're going to be more on the accommodationist side. The temptation for relevance in two kingdoms is to become more like the culture. However, with less common grace, with a view that the world is more evil, that God is less at work in it, there's going to be the tendency to separate. So those on the bottom, the transformationalist and the counterculturalist, they tend to be more separationist. So these, you can kind of think of these two, or their temptation is going to be to accommodate. These two, the temptation is going to be to separate. So then I just want to kind of talk about each one of those, and then what do we gain from each perspective as we try to be a faithful presence and incorporate the best. So the relevance perspective, it focuses on doing sacrificial service for the common good. Sacrificial service for the common good. So they have a high view that God is at work in culture, and that we, that matter is good, that God made the world good, that he's saving the world, that he's working in culture, not just through the church, but he's working in culture and all this to bring about good, and we need to just join him in what he's doing for the common good. So at a mild view of this, you have the seeker-sensitive movement. You get the emerging church movement. If you don't understand what those terms mean, that's not a big deal. But if you've heard some of these terms, just to kind of help you place. So seeker-sensitive movement would be like a Willow Church, emergence a little bit more, toward the relevant side, a liberal mainline churches, they're very much this way, very much about seeking the common good, but they tend to not emphasize doctrine as much as you go this way. Some of the weaknesses, though, of the relevance. It's susceptible to fads and being dated. So that you saw this happen with Willow Creek, for example, which is a great church, but they went to a very kind of corporate a sort of idiom and cultural kind of feel, even in their buildings in the 80s and the 90s. And now they're having to make shifts because as the culture shifted, that kind of cultural perception of a corporate world is less appealing to a newer generation. So when you go more relevance, you're always, the temptation is that we go with the latest fad, but we all know fads change. You look at your hairstyles from 10, 20 years ago, your clothes. I was watching Friends, the 90s The clothes were terrible. I'm sure I'm going to look at pictures of myself. And the more susceptible you are to fads, the more dated you become. So that's a weakness there. Also, the further in the relevance view, the more important culture becomes and the less important the Bible becomes. So the further you get on this trajectory in relevance, the more culture begins to become your final authority and Scripture becomes less important. And so if the culture says something, then you're going to find a way to make the Scriptures conform to that rather than the other way around. In light of this, one of the difficulties is, how is the church unique? Because what this really emphasizes is doing good works, serving the poor, doing common good, but because it doesn't have a strong proclamational perspective of really sharing the gospel, the question is like, well, what is the role of the church really? Because there's lots of nonprofit organizations that can serve the poor, that can do this kind of stuff, and in many cases do it much more effectively and efficiently than the church does it. So we really begin to say, okay, well, what then is the role of the church? What is its unique place in the culture, if not to proclaim the good news of the gospel, along with seeking the common good? But if it's not doing that, what is it? What is its unique role? Okay, so that's the relevance. So it's transformationalist. The focus here is on doing everything, thinking and living in all areas of life in a distinctively Christian manner. So it focuses on thinking and living in all areas of life in a distinctively Christian manner. So kind of neo-Calvinist I won't go on to all that, but I mean, even kind of go further down, you get to like a religious right. This is like a Jerry Falwell kind of I'm trying to think of the name of the group that Falwell was ahead of, the Christian Coalition or the, there you go, yeah. So this, again, the further you go here, it's all about worldview, about thinking. And so one of the weaknesses there is it's very cognitive. They love this idea of the transformative of your mind. If you can just get people to think rightly, then you're going to really change the culture. It also often has an underappreciation of the role of the church and an overappreciation for politics. So if we can get people to think rightly and get the right laws in place, then everything will be right. If we can just influence thinking, get the right laws in place, then we'll be in the right place. And it also tends to be really, can have a tendency to be triumphalistic, that we are bringing in God's kingdom, you know, and as we often say around here, that, you know, God's kingdom is never going to arrive on Air Force One, that there's going to be lots of good leaders and presidents, but Jesus is never going to roll in on Air Force One. We're never going to elect Jesus as president of the United States. So political power, it's important, it's really important, but it's not the final thing. But this view can begin to be tempted to think that. Then on to the counterculturist view, which is down here. Counterculturist. Counterculturist focuses on the church as being a contrast community, of being different than. It's a sign of the future kingdom. So if you talk to people who have a strong counterculturalist view, and you kind of see the new monastic movement, Shane Claiborne, if you've ever read any of his books, it's very much in the new monastic camp. John Howard Yoder, other thinkers in the kind of Anabaptist camp, all the way down to, if you take this to extreme, you get to the Amish perspective down here. And they really, the thinking here is that the culture, our role is to show forth what does God's kingdom look like, to sort of set it up in these small, in the communities of the church, and to be a counterculture, to be separate from the church and show this is what God's kingdom looks like. And to the extent that you do that, you withdraw. Because it's not at all about engaging. It's about setting up this alternate culture that's a critique of the culture, the broader culture. So it contrasts, a contrast community. It's showing the difference between God's kingdom and the kingdom of the world. It's the sign of the future kingdom. It's trying to anticipate what is it going to look like when Christ's kingdom does come in its fullness. But the weakness is here that it tends to be too pessimistic about cultural change, about the possibility of change. It kind of just gives up on the world a little bit and says, well, we're not going to try to be an influence here. We're just going to do our own thing. It also tends to demonize modern business and capital markets and the government in general. So the further you get down here, people are going to critique strongly capitalism, business, politics. You know, you got John Howard Yoder. They're all very, very highly critical of those things. And they say basically if the church or Christians are involved, they're colluding with the empire. You hear a lot of empire language in those camps. And then it also, ironically, it can undermine evangelism. Because this is a group where you hear a lot of this idea of belonging before you believe. So because they focus so much on our community as being the witness, they tend not to do a lot of verbal proclamation of the gospel. So it actually undermines, in a similar way, even though they're on opposite ends of the spectrum, these both undermine evangelism. Can undermine evangelism. They don't have to, but that can be the tendency, the temptation. And then lastly, two kingdoms up here. This is probably one that's toughest for me to understand exactly, but basically it says there's a common kingdom, this idea of common grace, and then there's the kingdom of the church, and God's kind of working these two kingdoms, and it focuses on the goodness of creation, and it centers on the dignity of secular vocation and the importance of doing work in a way that is marked by excellence in all that all can see. So it has a high value on work, which if you've been around Christ community, we know we think a lot about work and the goodness of work and work outside of the church. That's one of the strengths of this position. But the weaknesses here is that it really gives too much emphasis, more emphasis than the Bible gives to common grace. So for instance, this is how it would work out. You know, one of the classic examples that Two Kingdoms folks like to use is the example of William Wilberforce abolishing slavery in England. And they say, well, look, all this common grace. There's lots of people who weren't Christians who were involved in the abolition of the slave trade. God's common grace was that you don't necessarily even need the Bible or whatever to do this. But the failure there is to recognize how deeply influenced England was at a cultural level by the idea of human dignity that came from the Bible. So would we have just gotten that if we didn't have the Bible? So it tends to give an overemphasis on this common grace and not appreciate the extent to which Western culture in particular has been shaped by the Bible when it comes to things like human rights. Because we are so shaped, even when we don't recognize it, by the image of God and these kinds of things that come right out of Scripture, it places an overemphasis and it doesn't appreciate the amount that even our culture, even though how far it's shifted, but how deeply the idea of human rights comes right out of the Bible. It also can tend to be triumphalistic at times, and it can actually lead to sort of a quietism, because it sort of sees God at work in this, and by quietism, I mean just kind of a withdrawal or just not being very active in culture. Because it sees God's work through common grace, we don't really need to do a whole lot. It's just kind of, we don't need to get involved in work for change. So these are kind of those views. Now, then, when we think about, so where we need to do is then seek the center. So every one of these perspectives has biblical ideas in it and picks up on streams within the Bible that are important. And so we're all going to kind of have a tendency to probably go to one of these a little bit more naturally, but we want to always be pushing to the center. And so at Christ Community, we try to emphasize all of these. We want to seek the common good. We want to be much about the common good. We also, all about Raisers. Raisers, too, is having a distinctive worldview, thinking rightly about the world that God has made. We want to be a common culture or a counterculture as a church. We want to be a place where money and sex and power are used dramatically differently than in the rest of the world, that when people look at the church, they say, wow, these things that control and destroy us, money, sex, power, all these other idols, man, the church uses those in way different ways. That it is a counterculture, that it is a difference. And we also want to do our work with humble excellence, that we want to be a place that sees vocation as important and valuable, that we're doing all of our work, whether it's inside or outside the church, paid or unpaid, in ways that really show forth the glory of God and influence the common good. So we're not here. Christ Community isn't like right here. I wish, you know, we could say we were. But this is what we're seeking. Try to take these streams, common good, distinctive worldview, counterculture, and stay as close to the center as we can. Because when you're in the center, you're at the strongest points of all of these, and you're furthest from the weakest points. And it keeps you from being blinded. Because the further you get away from the center, the more blinded you become to the weaknesses of your position. Okay, so let's take a look then at Matthew 5, 13. Through 16. In this text, Jesus is a Sermon on the Mount, and This is a key text for understanding how we as a church are supposed to be about this work of relating to the culture. And this is the passage where, and we've already mentioned it here tonight, but this idea of the salt and light, this is where this comes out. So Matthew 5:13 says this, begin there. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are a light of the world. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people put a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light in all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. So first of all, just a couple things to point out in this passage, I think are really important for us to grasp as we think about this task of seeking this center, of being a faithful presence in our culture. First, these yous, when Jesus says, you are the salt of the light, you are the light of the world, those are plurals. He isn't saying you individually, Kylie, you individually, Cynthia, go do this. He's saying you, all of us as the church, together. It's a communitarian call that we do this together. So the hope of the world is not found in individuals, but in groups like local churches partnering together. The emphasis is corporate, not to the exclusion of the individual, but that we are to do this together. We often read that you in English, and we think me, but we should think we. Secondly, a transformed ontology. I think one of the most striking things about this passage is the matter-of-factness of how the community describes it. It says, you are. Ontology has to do with being, what something is. And it says, you are salt. You are light. It doesn't just say you're like salt or you are like light, but saying you as your role in the world, this is who you are. These are definitional statements. You are salt. You are light. We are called to be luminaries, reflectors of God. Then we see the metaphor of transformation. Both salt and light share the quality of transforming. And again, you kind of see this is probably where Christ community is most, where we would lean here. Even this kind of this language comes out, this transformation. This is kind of where maybe most naturally some of us would lean. But you see this metaphor of transformation. It's deeply embedded in Scripture. Both salt and light transform what comes into their presence. So if you turn on a light in a dark room, immediately you can see it transforms the room. Salt onto food, salt into a wound even. It transforms from to bring out the flavor of food or to cause pain. They both have the thing that both salt and light have in common is this kind of transforming quality to what they come into contact with. And then lastly, are two more things there, the imperative force and the doxological purpose. The imperative force, it says, you know, we have these in English when this is translated, it says, "Let you are the light of the world there, and it, let your light shine." This idea of, it almost seems like, well, you know, let it shine out, but it's a command. It really has a command. Shine your light, you could translate that. Not just sort of let your light shine seems a little bit weaker, but it's an imperative. It's a command. Shine your light. This is something you're to be doing. This is an optional. And if you think about it, if we truly are, if the ontology is right, if we are salt and we are light, we can't help but do this. But it has an imperatival force. Jesus is telling us to be who we are. We are not like the light, not like the light. We are the light. Be who we are. Shine your light. And then lastly, the doxological purpose. You see there at the end, that they may see your good works and give glory. Doxa is the Greek word for glory. It's a doxological focus. Give glory to your God, to the Father who is in heaven. The purpose of being a faithful presence in the culture is so the watching world to give glory to God. It's not about us having power. It's not about us having influence. It's ultimately that people would see and savor, to use John Piper's language, the glory of Jesus Christ. So a few final thoughts here as we close. Things to keep in mind. We've processed a lot here tonight. We need to remember, whenever we're thinking about culture, we always need to remember creation, fall, redemption, new creation. We've talked a little about the very beginning, but this four-chapter story, creation, fall, redemption, new creation, ought, is, can, and will. We need to remember that God created all things good. The world ought to be that everything that God made was good. So that The world around us isn't inherently bad. It's good. It's fallen, and that's why we need to keep the whole story in mind, but it's going to be redeemed, and one day it will be completely restored. If we keep those four chapters in mind, oftentimes we get in trouble because we only have a two chapter of the story. We think about fallenness and redemption, that the world is a broken, bad place, that God's going to redeem us out of it. But if we add those two chapters on either end, understanding that God made the world good, everything that he made is good, everything has been corrupted by sin, but he's going to redeem everything, it totally changes the way that we begin to think about anything from the way we build houses to the kind of art we do, the work we do, all these kinds of things. So remember always the creation, fall, redemption plotline of the Bible. Second, to seek the center. We all have a tendency to drift one of these directions. So seek the center, constantly be coming back to this center. So be seeking the center. Third, follow your convictions. You see, each one of us is gifted by the Holy Spirit with different gifts of teaching or mercy or administration or leadership. And because of our giftings, we're all going to be drawn to certain approaches more than others. So if you have a strong gift of mercy, if God has given you a gift of mercy, you're probably going to be really drawn to a relevance where you want to serve people, you want to help people. If you have a strong mind, a gift for teaching, you might be more down here on this, you're going to more naturally go into this transformationalist camp. You're just going to feel more at home here. But that's where it comes back to always seeking the center, remembering that we're all good. So follow your convictions. Don't try to make yourself into something that you're not, but keep yourself close to the center. Recognize that there may be tools. If you're really a strong mercy gift person, the authors, the thinkers, and the relevance camp are always going to appeal to you. Seek the best that they bring, but don't ever forget the weaknesses that also come along with each one of these perspectives. You know, as Christians, we're all called to evangelize. We're all called to serve the poor. But those are also gifts, right? Some of us will have the gift of evangelism, so we're going to feel really comfortable in that. Others are going to have the gift of mercy, so we're going to really thrive in that. We're all called to do all of them, but certain of us are going to be called into the strength of our giftedness. So follow your convictions, but seek the center. And then lastly, act, but don't react. And this is what we'll close with. Avoid arrogance, and this is all under act and don't react. Everyone gets part of the story right and wrong. We all get part of the story right, but we all get part of the story wrong. And so we have to remember that not only do we get this part of the story right, other people do as well. And it's a lot easier to see the log in other people's eyes, but remember that we have a log in our eye as well. So avoid arrogance. Also avoid blame. Maybe you grew up with one of these. Maybe you grew up in a counterculturalist camp or you were way down somewhere here in the religious right, and now you're reacting against that. And you just can't see any goodness. I mean, sometimes, you know, they say there's no, you know, there's no person who's more strongly for their position than when they were converted from some other position. So avoid blame. Don't blame another model for all the problems in the world. Also avoid frustration. You may be in a context, maybe you do have a strong mercy gift, but you're with a bunch of people who have kind of gathered together and they really have a strong kind of more of a teaching, and they're really into this thing of worldview and mind, and you're saying, man, this just doesn't connect with me. Avoid frustration. Seek the center, but don't let them push you to become more extreme. Sometimes when we're in the context of a smaller, when we feel like we're a minority, it makes us more extreme in our position. Don't let that happen. And then lastly, avoid naivete. No one church, we at Christ Community are going to invest, no one church can perfectly incorporate or transcend all these models. And this is, I love this quote from Keller. He says, so in light of that, and this is what we'll end with, enjoy the strengths of your position, admit the weaknesses of it, and borrow like crazy from the strength of the other positions. If we're doing that, if we're enjoying our strengths of ours, we're admitting our weaknesses, and we're borrowing like crazy from the strengths of others, we will begin to be a faithful presence in our culture that people will look at us and the work that we do, and they will give glory to the Father who is in heaven. Have a great time in your small groups.